This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the show, we talk about prairies. We'll talk about how the prairies of the region were formed, prairie plants, the value of prairies, preservation and restoration efforts, and other topics. Our guests include prairie preservationist Dave Monk and Fran Hardy of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. As we talk, we hope you'll join the conversation. Your comments, questions, observations are welcome. The telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside the local dialing area, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. You may recall last hearing Dave Monk's name this fall as he worked to save a stretch of prairie along Route 45 in Savoy, south of Champaign. That piece of prairie has been lost to a road widening project. Dave Monk has been active in education and preservation for many years in east central Illinois. Also with us today, Fran Hardy. He has spent many years studying the natural features of the Joliet Arsenal, and he is with the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. There are plans to transform a large portion of the old arsenal into a 19,000-acre national prairie park. The proposal was part of a defense spending authorization bill that was vetoed last week. President Clinton's objections to the bill, however, were not related to the prairie proposal, and that prairie proposal is still in the works. It's just a matter, I think, of how it will all come together. Again, do feel free to give us a call this afternoon, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, or if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area, the local number, 333-9455. Fran Hardy, Dave Monk, welcome. Good afternoon.
Thanks for having us on.
Good afternoon.
Nice to have you here. I want to start with something very basic. When I hear the word prairie, I know I think of Illinois, the prairie state. Once upon a time, anyway, the prairie state. Today, very little high-quality prairie remains. I know that prairie in this part of the country often involves tall grasses. I know the Little House on the Prairie stories. And I could probably name a few prairie plants. But that's about it. So I really don't have a very good working kind of understanding of what prairie means, what it is. How would you define it, Fran?
Well, definition is kind of difficult for prairie, but the concept that I think people need to understand is Illinois had about 22 million acres of prairie in pre-settlement time before Eurasian settlement. So that gives you an idea how much prairie was actually here. Today there's about 25 million acres of row crop. So essentially most of that prairie's gone, and that's essentially why. It's very productive soil, and once the Europeans figured out that it was productive, then it became one of the richest commodities of the New World. So both from a grazing point of view and also for raising crops. So the loss has been incredible.
Yeah. Now, Dave Monk, I guess it is the prairie that has given us this very rich soil that now we are growing.
Well, actually, it's
crops.
The geology, the fact that there was glaciation and it eroded the Laurentian Shield in Canada and brought us very rich glacial till, which it mounded up in various places where the world was at a certain warmth for a time. It gave us the moraines like Yankee Ridge Moraine or Cerro Gordo Moraine. Each community in the northern part of Illinois has these characteristic remains, moraines, which are little bumps. And after glaciation, after the world warmed up and the ice and snow moved north, then plants came back in from refugio or other places, and the prairie was one of the first to come back in, and it's more able to handle wettish sort of territory. This county was extremely wet, and so forests come in, they come in along the waterways, but they don't like wet feet. They like water, but they don't like wet feet, and they don't have quite the same ability to tromp across the landscape as an ecosystem. So prairie came, and 94% of Champaign County was indeed prairie, and you could row a boat in spring. See, you've got early spring rain, then summer drought, then fall rain.
Yeah.
And we only became productive here because we brought in Deutschlanders and others that knew how to drain, and they got that water off. Now the prairies that we have are somewhat more like what we would have had further west because
it's
not as wet. But there are pockets. And one of the pockets that you spoke about on South 45 was a very neat one because it had the wet prairie on drummer soil, and then it had the dry prairie, and then it had a modest prairie, Drummer Flanagan Association.
Yeah. Let's revisit that time for just a moment here. That was an effort this summer to try to save, and this fall to try and save that stretch of prairie.
Well,
there.
I'm Australian in background, and I came partially to find out about prairie, and ecologists like Dr. Bliss and others introduced me to this corridor as a rather wonderful example of prairie. So it's not something that happened last summer. We've known that this road is going to possibly take this territory for 20 years. It's how to... part of the non-profit work that I do is to try and convince people to think about what they're losing. Much of those three soil types and those three little prairies hasn't even been documented, especially the bacterial side of it, the rhizosphere of the roots and things like that. And so we desperately tried to ask the Department of Transportation to go around that prairie. We got left off at various stages. No real good species list. No impact statement. Where the federal agencies had to be obeyed because there's federal money in it, they'd look for artifacts and endangered species and things like that. But this was not what people thought was valuable. It's a C-grade prairie, after all, and it's a degraded C-grade prairie. And it doesn't look like the best and only piece of 10,000-year-old prairie in Champaign County, but it was. And it had diversity. It had about 80 species. It had little orchids and enough of the species that you just didn't have a concentration of a few in one spot. It was not like a weedy grassland. It was very, very natural, even though disturbed. And so it was very sad to lose this, our only remaining acre in 600,000 acres in Champaign County. And I couldn't believe that could happen in this society. We can run off to save the rainforest. We can do all sorts of things. But here, right here, we're taking it out. And roads can go around this some, but we had a lot of opposition from development and other interests.
So you're saying that was the very last acre of prairie?
Intact, in
Champaign
County. And a catena of soils, so that the soils were related to each other. We have another reasonable place at Rantoul, north of Rantoul, and also right up towards Park Forest South in Chicago, that little piece that runs alongside 45 between the railroad and the road is tremendously valuable. But you can guess what's going to happen when Route 45 gets widened. So as a result of this, we want to change the law so that you don't... one of the problems is that a mile is used as the figure. If you have a mile of prairie, then the Illinois Nature Preserves Commission gets into the act and a few others, and you do have to have an impact statement. This was less than a mile because we don't have anything else. And so we would like to see that law change some so that those counties that have nothing are respected for what they do have. Now, some of this gives Department of Transportation their due. They moved to a pisodum rest stop, not the same soil type, and it's not going to be original. And they moved some of the top 10 inches of soil north and again into a detention pond. Not the same. But we had a lot of opportunity to educate people with this. And we hope that in the future we or people like Fran will be included in the planning process. This was too cruel. And you'll notice that the road now is to within 10 feet of the railroad line. And so in an era when the governor is asking and begging for greenways, we have completely exterminated our little greenway further south. And our next neat little prairie is Kinmundi, 100 mile away. So it depends what you want. If your child's going to grow up on concrete, well, they'll enjoy concrete. But there are things we think that they ought to see.
Yeah. Fran Hardy, talk with us from your point of view about the value of prairie. Dave Monk has talked very passionately about it. But it also sounds like we don't understand yet what all is involved in prairie and how it all works. And Dave mentioned the bacteria and...
Well, the prairie has got a lot of things yet that we don't know about, and there's a lot of real good researchers here in Illinois at the Natural History Survey and Illinois State and other places that are studying that fairly hard, and we get new discoveries all the time. But I think some of the things we do know that are very significant is the fact that the soil is, some of the richest soil in the world comes built on prairie and beneath prairie. The other thing we found out in the last couple of years is the relationship of prairie size to particularly animal species. Many of your listeners may have watched the WLL PBS show the other night about forest interior birds that need large tracts of forest. Well, there are grassland birds that are equally sensitive to size, and that's why the Joliet Arsenal is such an important project. 19,000 acres in one place in Illinois that's still grassland is incredible. About 6,000 acres of the arsenal is actually in grassland of one kind or another. Contains the largest concentration of upland sandpipers in the state, which is one of our endangered birds. It likes approximately 100 acres of pasture grasslands that's short grass. So most of our prairies are really tiny, like the ones that Dave was just talking about, under an acre, maybe a mile long, but very narrow. These species won't nest there. They're just not big enough. It's, for lack of a more technical way of explaining it, it's sort of psychological. If it's not big enough, they're just not going to breed there. So we have these, we call them prairie management paradoxes, where you might have 100 acres. If you grazed it short, you might get a pair of upland sandpipers. But then you wouldn't get another species called the bobolink, which also likes 100-acre pastures, but it likes tall grass. So if you manage for one, you're managing against another. So that's why scale is so important. And anytime you have a real long, narrow expanse of prairie, some of these species just won't be there. Or if you have, like at the Arsenal, 6,000-acre chunks of grassland, some as large as 640 acres, those species will be there. So there are a lot of interesting things, connections now that we're making, that size is actually something we're looking, you know, very seriously at. To be sort of terse about it, the bigger the better in some ways. And where they're not large, connections are a way of making things work. Now, the downside, of course, is sometimes when you connect things, you're actually making travel ways for disease, predators, and other things. So there's pros and cons, but generally the pros outweigh the cons as far as these large-scale projects.
Yeah, a large-scale project, 19,000 acres, that's a lot, it would seem, to manage. Mother Nature probably can do it quite well, but it must be quite a task for people to do.
Well, actually, when we talk about the 19,000 acres of Joliet, it's actually larger. This couldn't have been better situated. It's right at the confluence of the Kankakee and Des Plaines River, where they meet to form the Illinois. And right next to the Joliet Arsenal is the Des Plaines Conservation Area, which is about 4,000 acres that we manage. And to the north is another 4,000 acres of military land that's not being surplus now that probably will be in the next 20 years. And within 8 miles or so, as the crow flies, or in this case the sandpiper, to the west is Goose Lake Prairie, which is the largest native tallgrass prairie east of the Mississippi. In between this 8 mile area is a lot of corporate land, some of it that we actually lease from Commonwealth Edison, Hyde-Gee Lake. So if you start adding this all up, and those of you quick with math, we're almost at 40,000 acres. And it's an incredible amount of land in a block, essentially wild land, within 40 miles of downtown Chicago. So the opportunity is just, we oftentimes call this a chance of a lifetime. It really isn't. It's the only chance. Yeah. You could never assemble 40,000 acres at the headwaters of the Illinois River if you went about to do it acre by acre. It just couldn't be done.
There's something else that's very interesting about Joliet, too, is that it has a history. It's there because Hawaii didn't have enough TNT to run a war. And all of a sudden, 18 farms were consumed and buildings put up to near a population base so that and there's something like 65-mile railroad lines or something?
Well, there's 166 miles of rail on the site, and it's one of 60 of these plants that were built in anticipation of World War II. Even some of it started before Pearl Harbor. But as Dave mentioned, it was built in farmland areas. Several reasons. One is they needed a lot of source of workers, and a lot of the farm communities had that because the men were home working the farms during the day and then working the lines at night. In addition, they needed lots of water for fire protection, number one, it's a munitions plant, and also for the process of doing the TNT production. So 60 of these were built between 1940 and 1942. And as Dave mentioned, there's essentially no TNT owned by the or produced by the United States government before World War II. It was all privately done, like DuPont, Hercules Power. Both of those companies actually played a role in developing Joliet. And once it was online, it produced about 5.5 million tons of TNT a week. It was one of the major producers for the war effort. And then ultimately it closed down and came back for Korea, closed down and came back for Vietnam. And I think the last TNT was actually produced there in 1967.
Hmm. So when you look at the prairie, you can't only look at the plants and the animals. You have to look at the people and how Caucasians have come in and how things have happened. And as you go past little buildings or cemeteries, you start to look at them and how they may relate now.
I think Dave's point about you have to consider the people is another real success story with the arsenal. There actually was a concept plan put together. The retired Congressman George Sangmeister actually was a person who essentially started the ball rolling, put together a 24-member committee of folks to look at the Joliet Arsenal and see what the best use would be for that property. And out of that commission, we unanimously agreed to a concept plan that included a 1,000-acre national cemetery, a 19,000-acre prairie, two industrial parks that add up to about 3,000 acres, and a 455-acre county landfill. So that's very incredible to think that that was unanimously agreed to by this diverse group of people. And 24 people, you can't agree on what restaurant to go to, let alone something as complex as this. And it's an amazing concept plan that's got essentially support of everybody.
And this will be a national prairie, not just an Illinois prairie.
Right, it'll be the first national tallgrass prairie. Mm-hmm.
And it's in the wet part of the Prairie Peninsula, which runs sort of out towards Ohio and down towards the Mississippi and up towards Canada. And it's very different, this prairie, than if you go to Colorado and get an inch-high dry prairie. And so this is the representative, and it will be good. But it doesn't totally replace the need for something locally, and that's what we're interested in, is how we relate to that sort of major effort. Sometimes you can't even get someone from Champaign to go to Busey Woods, let alone get someone to go to Joliet Arsenal or to Goose Lake Prairie. And so we needle and tweak, because people don't know what a prairie is. It's six generations, but in that time they've had to dig the soil, drain the soil, become nouveau riche, and So we're still making money out of the prairie, but there comes a time when you want to save something. This is Illinois. We've got an Illinois bundleweed, which is a legume, which is sometimes called Illinois bundleflower, because we don't like to have our prairie called weeds, warts, curses, and everything else. But this is really Illinois bundleweed, which has the same protein content as soybeans. And so we have researchers now that are looking at this plant as a perennial crop, so that you don't have to plow and erode every year. And so that we do it in a prairie, so that all the symbiosis from the little organisms that are on the roots and like will help to give the fertilizer, so you don't have to put all those chemicals in. And it will help to purify the water, and or at least not allow quite so much chemical in the water. So it probably needs 5,000 genetic engineers and a lot of research before this thing can be going through a header of a... But, you know, we didn't have soybeans here till 1936. And so give it 50 years. The seeds shatter at the moment. And there needs a lot of research before it can be grown effectively.
Well, is it a perennial in that it seeds itself then, or is it a...
Oh, yes, it's a very nice grower. We have it on our prairies. And it will grow, but this is an ecosystem. It doesn't grow dramatically. These plants, there'll be a clump, and as Fran says, you have to have a certain area for it to express itself. It doesn't express itself dramatically, as you will see a monocrop like corn or soybeans. If it gets a disease, it'll get it in a few plants, and the rest will go around it. And so it's sort of a gentle thing. And very few people know what it is. They can't distinguish prairie from weeds. And so we do a lot of work trying to educate people. And also people who are engineers and people who have to deal with working with the prairie don't know an awful lot about it. So here's an interesting letter that I got just the other day. It's from a farmer, but it's from the Rotary Club. And sometimes we have to work within the community with small groups and do interesting things. So this farmer is we're going to get some money from the funds that are created in Rotary when somebody has a grandchild or something like this. But the person who is talking to me is a farmer, and he has a plot of land right on the Pasota Moraine. And now the Pasota Moraine, because it's a little higher, had tremendous erosion during the spring. And it butts right up against 57, which runs down the front of the moraine. And so there are little plots in here that we're thinking about bringing people together, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Transportation, Farm Bureau, Soil Conservation Committee, university, the newly reconstructed university with its interest in environment and more interdisciplinary things. We're looking at how close it is to a viable body of travelers. We lost a little prairie that had 10,000 cars a day and an airport with overseas people nearby. And I said, how can we replace this? Could this group, say the Rotary Club or others, come together and start to look after the prairie plants that we have at the Presodum Rest Stop? And could we have a little announcement on a radio as you came in from Arcola and say, we've got a good example of drainage on Presodum. This just 4 miles, you jump off the highway and have a look at what we're doing. It's so hard to farm, and here these guys are doing it, and they're doing it well. And that sort of sense of community starts the ball rolling. And we have then educated people who can look at a purple coneflower and say, hey, what's that white one doing there? That might have a different chemical in it. What? Hey, it has a different bug on it. And what's the bug doing there? And how does that relate to the well health of your pituitary gland? So we have to have these little prairies in order to provide for next generations and sometimes for the rest of the world. If we get a soybean, it may have come from China or somewhere else. It doesn't necessarily come from here, but we have to be generous enough to save our stuff so that we can give it to someone in Africa or somewhere else where it might grow better. Mm. But if it's not there, it's not there.
And if I get sparked by the Pasota Moraine, then I'm going to go see
the
Tallgrass Prairie in Joliet. We're talking this afternoon about prairies. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, prairie preservationist David Monk, also with us Fran Hardy of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. You're welcome to join us this afternoon as well, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And we have a caller waiting on line 4 in Salem waiting to talk with us. Hello.
Hi, I'm in South Central Illinois, Marion County. I wondered if there are any workshops or programs down here. I know the northern part of the state is real big on prairie restoration. And I also had another question on the Illinois bundle flower. What part is used for the protein? Or for cooking or for using?
The seeds, the little seeds that we have some difficulty harvesting, one because they shatter and one because they're hard to get out of the pods when you do try to get them out. We don't have harvest techniques, but that's the piece that's rich. But we don't know. There may be rosins in the stems. There may be other things that we don't know about. But Fran might have a comment on that.
They do use the seed. It's just like a soybean. The seed is actually where the oils would come from. Regarding your earlier question about prairie conferences and things like workshops, this coming October in northern Illinois at the Pheasant Run Resort will be the site for the North American Prairie Conference as well as the Natural Areas Conference. And that'll prove to be a very large, largely attended conference and workshop. They do a lot with prairie and other natural areas. As far as down near Salem, I don't know of anything right now that's scheduled, but that would be the next really big one.
There's six nice little prairies along the area near you in Kanmundi on the railroad line.
I followed that, yes. I live real close to that.
But I would also encourage you to get up steam and get a few people and go to the North American Prairie Conference. Started in Illinois by a gentleman named Pete Schramm from Galesburg, who's head of the biology department there. And he does a lot of avocational planting of prairie. He keeps drills and has seed, and he'll come and plant you a prairie, a garden prairie.
I did have the Illinois Conservation Society come out and do that, but it was in one of the worst drought years, and they brought me forbs and seeds in August or it was, I guess it was July, but they never, hardly anything took. Some big blue stem did. I have about...
In July, it's getting late in the year, and if you had a dry season, then it's a little hard for that to catch on. Normally, the prairie would have grown in the spring. We don't plant it in the spring usually because there are so many weeds, farm weeds, that they would compete. So we tend to plant in May, and then if you're lucky, you'll have a water source where you can pump some water on it for a while, or at least you'll have some rainfall. So don't give up, however. Some of those seeds take a long time. They may sit in the soil for 30 years, and some of the plants don't grow fast. A compass plant might be 8 years old before it flowers. You will see its vegetative parts, but don't give up on your little prairie and dig it in, because it might have things there.
And a burn works good too, right?
Yes, a burn will help to burst the tester of the seeds in some cases, and it will remove the litter. If you've got a bunch of weeds, it'll remove the competing weeds.
It's almost total goldenrod.
Goldenrod often comes in by itself. I doubt if anyone, Shram included, would put goldenrod
in. Before they even planted, the field was goldenrod. It was just a... I think I need to burn that out first.
Yes, burning is a very helpful tool, and it has been avoided some because of the smoky bear syndrome. Forests also need to be burned too, but it needs to be under controlled circumstances. Just don't go out there with a match and let fire to it.
One more question I had. Is there any where I can get seeds for my area so it stays... indigenous to my area, are there in southern Illinois?
Very good question. This is a lot of debate. We try to keep within 50 miles of where we are. But there's not a lot of good sources for seed. A lot of it is you becoming aware, and you go along the railroad line and perhaps pick up some seed. But be cautious. Don't wander onto somebody's pet railroad project and collect all the seed. You might get yourself into difficulty. But ask, and you will often find people who are locally working on that sort of thing and have a source of seed.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm glad you're doing that to the arsenal, because that's a real eyesore, and it's so nice to hear prairie will be there. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think so, too.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. You know, the question of seed, Fran Hardy, you mentioned we're talking about roughly about 19,000 acres at Joliet. And you said 6,000 acres is now grassland, or is prairie?
Well, 6,000 acres in grassland. It's not all prairie.
Okay.
There is some prairie on the property, but most of it is cool season grasses, grasses that have been planted. And that's another interesting part about this prairie business. If you're interested in just prairie plants, then that's one thing. If you're interested in prairie birds, the birds don't care. They care more about structure, litter, and how big it is. So you can actually sustain a lot of prairie birds without actually having prairie plants. And that's a good thing, because if it wasn't the case, we essentially have 0.01% of prairie left in the state.
Right.
If all these birds were that linked to actual prairie plants, we would have no prairie birds.
Yeah.
So they're interested in structure, and that's what we can do with even Eurasian grasses.
I would imagine, though, also that you would be interested in restoring prairie plants.
Oh, absolutely. That's...
So then how do you manage that kind of acreage and seed is apparently a problem?
Well, that's actually two questions.
Okay.
What do we do with the 6,000 acres of cool season grasses that have all this habitat for endangered species, in this case a lot of particularly prairie birds? Well, there's also 10,000 acres of row crop at the arsenal. So what we can do is start to restore prairie plants to some of the agricultural lands in a progression that's rather slow, obviously, because seed source will be a very limited commodity. So the restoration of the arsenal is going to be, you know, a 50, 60, maybe 100-year project.
Wow.
Before it's all over. But and there's two ways you can do that. You can actually plant a lot of prairie with machines these days. We're at the state of the art now. We can do it. But there's a lot to be said by planting it by hand. For example, again, within 40 miles of Chicago, if all the school districts had a quarter acre and it was their project, you could essentially go through high school planting prairie at the Joliet Arsenal, and you would essentially then contributed to the reconstruction of the prairie.
What a neat idea.
My word, but you have to be very cautious. You have to watch the janitor, because when comes summer and no one's at the school, he will probably exterminate the prairie as a bunch of weeds. You have to talk to school administrators, because they are frightened that someone will get raped in the prairie. It's very, very hard. If you want to plant a prairie in an urban area, you have to almost go and make an ordinance, and it takes 5 years to get an ordinance through the city council to have a little prairie. We have a little prairie near the railroad line in downtown Champaign, and it does wonders. I get little letters all the time saying, hey, thank you. What? It tells people about prairie. In our area, we have Audubon, and we have Grand Prairie Friends, and groups that are oriented to putting prairie in plots. And this, we have a Meadowbrook Park, which has increased, I think it's got now 40, 45 acres almost. It's got a lot of prairies that's planted on cornfield, and they have also plots of various species that they grow and cultivate and harvest the seeds, and have work days where they. These things are not easy to deal with. They prickle your hands. You need certain techniques. But we need lots of little efforts from all over. I brought along a magazine that was from Cranet Arts Centre. And here, just one prairie seed has been featured on this thing. And when it was the 25-year stage, they said, oh, here's some prairie seeds, and perhaps in the next 25 years, as these prairie seeds grow, then will Cranet Arts Centre. And so you would be surprised where it comes up sometimes and how it gets done. Many, many voices.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a couple of folks waiting to talk with us on line one in Hennepin.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm really interested in this program. We've got, when we built our home and moved in March of 83, it's in the country south of Hennepin, and my husband decided that he was going to put a part of the front, which is almost an acre, in prairie. And so we had a company come out and drill the seed in. Now it's been, 13 years, and it keeps on growing. And now we burn it annually about the 15th or the middle of March, and then everything clears off and green is coming up within 6 to 7 days. And it's strange to me, though. And a friend came out and who works for a county agency of some kind and ask if we would like to have a sign that says prairie plants do not disturb, and we said, well, sure we do. So we put that in, and then people come and look at it and just drive by slowly and all that, and then we put some prairie plants in, and some survive and some don't, and then other things come up. It's quite beautiful out in there, but it's so strange to me that the turkey foot is really tall, and what else is tall? The switchgrass.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it has not, you know, it seems like they're, well, it's all green, of course, but it seems like it has grown, to me, spottily, and my husband said, oh, no, you know, it takes years and all this, but that does seem, you know, a little bit peculiar to me.
What part seems peculiar? The fact that it grows?
It's kind of spotty. You know, some grows beautifully, particularly the part right along the asphalt driveway. It just seems really lush.
It's a little extra nitrogen.
Perhaps. But when you do plant prairie, especially if it's seeded, if it's drilled in, then you're going to have spotty, depending on how the individual seeds are put in the ground.
Oh.
And individual plants, as they grow, as Dave mentioned earlier, they'll get very large. The root systems will get very large, and then the bunch grasses, the big blue stem and the Indian grass, will get very large, bunchy-type bases to them.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they'll crowd out another one, and then another place might be completely bare.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to do something with those bare spots, if it's really a distraction to you, is just go ahead and replant those spots, dig them up and plant some more seeds, or put some forb rootstock in.
We call it dipsy doodling. You go out and you take a grassy prairie, and instead of digging it up, you plant seeds in it.
Okay.
And also get used to a prairie being very different from a horticultural plot.
Yes.
The flowers are small. They flower for a short time. It's not the same as looking at the plot of petunias.
Well, I realize.
So you get out with your lens and you look at the relationship between plants and animals. You look at compass plant and look at its north-south direction. Just a whole lot of things that are very different, and they're beautiful in a totally different sense, and I think we're very, very poorly educated about that.
Well, I would totally agree with that. Now, do you think the spotty places will, certainly it's not bare soil, of course, will tend to fill in with more passage of time?
Maybe. You can change its mind if you want. You might bring in a truck of sand and plant some cacti if you want a dry prairie, for instance. You might put a glacial erratic there because that's where this healthy soil came from. It might be that you have a low spot and you encourage some lowland species. Okay. It might be you encourage an eight-line ground squirrel and have an ant's nest or something, a butterfly. Just put some creatures in there.
Okay.
Are you in Lee County?
No, we're in Putnam County.
You're in Putnam?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It's the smallest county in the state.
Right. Yeah.
But it has some nice prairies. And you also relate to the Indians. In fact, in Henry, the Henry has an Indian trail road, which says there were Indians there.
Yes.
And what did they do? So do you have Indian artifacts, and how did they relate to the prairies?
Yes.
Well, you might talk with the Putnam County Conservation District. Uh-huh. Even though it's the smallest county, it's one of the ones that has a forest reserve district, and they might have some advice. You know, sometimes it's kind of like doing medicine over the radio. It's easier sometimes to tell you if somebody came out and really looked at it for you than.
Okay.
And you also have water. You're near the water, and there are interesting wetland things, I'm sure, that go on there.
All righty. Well, this is really interesting, and thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. Let's go on to a caller on line 4 in Herrick. Hello.
Hi. I kind of got a question that relates to the statement about not getting the chance to get a lot of acreage together. I'm from Alaska, and there's a certain movement up there to get rid of a lot of the national park and Forest Service grounds up there. There's about 600 million acres in Alaska, and less than 1 million acres has been developed to any extent. And there's a big feeling, of course, that it stifles the development up there. And one of the ideas that has been kind of bandied about was to trade park ground from there to here, essentially because of the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of people up there to take advantage of it. And on the other hand, it's, like you say, it would be very tough to get 1 million acres together, say, in Illinois, where there are a lot of people that would take advantage of it. The idea would be that you would take and sell, say, 1 million acres out of a preserve of some sort up there and essentially trade it for 1 million acres or, you know, they say equivalent dollars worth of ground here. And I just kind of wondered what your viewpoint on that would be coming from an environmentalist look at it.
Well, the two things about that. One would be if you were going to decide, you know, which acres in Alaska is going to be sold, I'm sure that there'd be so many people that would be for it, so many people against it, and would be one of those things that would get caught up in a very long political issue. But probably the most limiting factor in the lower 48 would be not all land that you want is for sale. So even if you had the money, trying to assemble that kind of acreage in the right places is what's so very hard to do. Price is incredible. I mean, you could have a lot of money, and if you try and buy land in Cook County, they sell it by the square inch. So it's a very difficult proposition. A lot of these things sound fairly good on paper that, well, if A happens, B happens. But in real-life negotiations, it's just almost impossible to do.
Well, I can see how it might be difficult to buy 1 million acres at one swatch. But assuming that we're in this for the long haul, I would imagine it'd be like all some of the parks that were developed out east, where they bought as much as they could at one pitch, and then over the next 50 years or so, they just keep working at it. And like you say, you'll never get all of it, but eventually you'll get enough to where you won't be, like you say, you're dealing with what, 40,000 acres down here,
mm-hmm.
and you know, 40,000 acres is it's nothing. It's not 1% of the state down here, even.
That's exactly true. But if you added up the amount of money it would cost to buy that, it would be astronomical.
Well, essentially, what's being talked about is trading. And you're right, the numbers are huge, but the idea, I guess, is more to even out the wilderness opportunities to everybody.
Well, I mean, if that's the real issue, then I'd rather see them figure out ways to get more people to Alaska and back than to sell large tracts of Alaska. If you're really taking the long view, Alaska may be the last place on Earth that is wild enough to sustain species like grizzly bears. We're talking about things in Illinois that need 100 acres as a minimum to exist, a small bird about the size of a pigeon that lives on the ground. You start talking about things like grizzly bears and wolves, you need lots of space and you need very few people, otherwise they're not going to make it.
Oh, yeah, I would assume that you would never even get Alaska to the stage where it was down to, maybe even down to two-thirds of the state being left in park and wilderness. But even at doing that stage, it would mean leaving about 200 million acres to be divided in the rest of the states. And when you think about how valuable just, even just 500,000 acres would be within 100 miles of Chicago, it seems like a pretty good idea to me.
Well, let's take that analogy. When people first moved into Illinois, there was 22 million acres of prairie, and they thought that they would never, ever see the end of prairie. They thought that it would be here so long that they didn't even bother to set apart a square mile of it anywhere.
Not one single acre in Champaign County.
And a whole continent, essentially, has been looked at that way. I mean, the whole North American continent was considered to be, there for the asking, there to always be more, and now we're down to what? Alaska. And so what you're really doing is carrying that analogy on further, and I, for one, historically, looking back through, would say, no, it's not a good idea.
Well, no, you went around the Mesopotamia, you went around the Mediterranean, you went through Europe, you went through North America, and now you're into the rainforest. People are people wherever they are, and they're going to eat this stuff up. So we need
to see here what we're doing is we're not coming up with any less. We're just having it in a different place.
Yes.
And you're right about what you said about, nothing being set back for preserve here. And I've always considered it to be a shame that the wilderness areas that we've got in America are basically the crap. It boils right down to that. Anything that was good, the places that had the tremendous production like the prairies did, they were eaten up quickly.
Well, you're confusing two things. One is the national park system was often considered land that no one wanted because it was rocky and hilly and essentially scenic. But other public lands, for example, the BLM lands and the Bureau of Indian Affairs lands and Alaska lands, are very valuable. Otherwise, people wouldn't want to be logging them. I mean, they are valuable pieces of property, and they're becoming more valuable every day because of their natural resources. They're full of gold. Things that no one mined before, we mine now. So they are very valuable lands, and I don't think, for one, myself, I wouldn't want to see part of the Tongass National Forest be exchanged for 100,000 acres of cropland in Illinois. It's a completely different system. It just wouldn't be the right thing to do from an environmental
You'd
conservation
point. You'd have to spend 10,000 years getting the prairie back on it. I would like to say that some of the sorts of thinking that you're at are going on. Groups like the Nature Conservancy have started to actually go and buy land in other countries like rainforest, and they're working with commerce. We ourselves on South 45, for instance, I went to Kinko's to ask if we could do something with a publication that would let people know about prairie because they can't afford the time or don't know about prairie and don't see it. So you have to take the visual to them. But then you are involving industry, you're involving commerce, and they're the people that will help to put together Ducks Unlimited and the Pheasants Forever and the groups that you're begging to do. So actually a lot of preservation that has happened has come through commerce and industry and very conservative elements within the society, and I feel so grateful for that.
Just to give you an idea of the recreational impact, just in Illinois alone, which is really not a large recreational state compared to others, it's a $15 billion a year business, outdoor recreation. So there's a lot of money in it. And it is things that people can do to make money from the outdoor recreational activities.
We're out of time. I'm really sorry to say. I hope the two of you will come back because I think we've just barely scratched an inch of soil here.
Thanks very much
for
having us.
Thanks for having us.
I do want to ask Fran before we go, what's the outlook for the legislation to get this thing rolling in Joliet?
Well, there's two things that could happen. One is the defense authorization bill could resurrect itself depending on how things are taken out of it, things that people didn't agree with, and maybe that would come back through and then be signed into law. The other avenue, plan B, so to speak, it would be to actually put together a self-standing bill. The Arsenal bill, through Congressman Weller's effort, did pass the House, and Senator Simon and Senator Kara Mosley Braun essentially had a companion bill in the Senate. So those could be put together, put together in format that would be the same, then passed through the Senate and back through the House.
Who do they have to call?
Well, it's really not a matter of calling anybody.
It's a bipartisan thing. It's just a matter of getting it all ironed out, as they say.
In the big picture, it's a small bill. But in Illinois, of course, it's a major, major bill, and we all want to see it get done. But there's 50 other states, and they'll have their favorite bills, too.
Well, I want to thank you again, the two of you, for coming in. Thanks so much. Fran Hardy of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and prairie preservationist David Monk. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, chances are when you gathered with friends and family over the holidays, you shared food and drink. And today on the Afternoon Magazine, what we're going to do is look at the communal feasting and festivals of Native Americans. We'll talk with Barry Kavash. She's a food historian and cookbook author. We'll talk with her about Native American cooking and culture. As we talk, you should feel free to join us with your telephone calls. Questions and comments, requests for recipes are welcome. Here are the numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Outside the local dialing area, anywhere you're listening, use the toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Barry Kavash is an author, ethnobotanist, and food historian. Her first book was Native Harvests. Her latest book is Enduring Harvests. Barry Kavash is also a trustee and research associate of the Institute for American Indian Studies in Washington, Connecticut. Enduring Harvests includes recipes and information about major seasonal celebrations from the Peruvian Andes and North America all the way to the Arctic. It is published by the Globe Pequot Press. Calls are encouraged. The numbers toll-free, 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Barry Kavash, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Celeste. It's a pleasure.
How are you?
Just great. Good. How are you?
Very, very nice. Very, I'm comfortably warm, and we're looking out the window today at some snow that's falling here in Illinois and Indiana.
Oh, it's beautiful here in Connecticut, too. We had flurries this morning, and we've got about 14 inches base.
Wow. You're ahead of us, but we're catching up.
Well, you usually surpass us.
I didn't know that, and I would think that Connecticut would get much more snow than us. But
well, this winter we intend to try to do that.
Yeah, get out there and get some skiing in.
Oh, yes, and some snowshoeing, or like the older types like me, just the enjoyment of tracking. And there's a lot to look after and follow in tracks in the snow now.
Oh, what do you track?
Well, we have coyote here in the Northwest Hills. We have quite a lot of deer. We have ever so many songbirds and game birds and wild turkeys, which leave incredible tracks in the snow.
Oh.
Looks like Bigfoot has been by.
You are a Cherokee Creek, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Powhatan?
Yes.
Descent, also with some Scots-Irish, English, and German thrown in as well. Was your Native American ancestry always a part of your life and your family's life, or did you have to kind of seek it out?
Very much more the latter. We are a medley, as you might imagine, from the preface you just gave, and growing up both in Ohio, where I was born, and in Tennessee and Alabama, where my mother's and father's folks came from and still live, there has always been a great interest to live white, live you know, in the mainstream, and most of my folks were farmers and self-sufficient, working at, you know, close to the earth. So mm-hmm. there really was not a big deal made about ethnicity mm-hmm. ever. We never really had a feeling that we were of one stripe or another, and our friends, like our house, always looked like a League of Nations. Yeah. There were always many different types and groups of people around our tables.
Yeah. I wonder then if having to seek out your heritage, your native heritage, that led you to your work in ethnobotany, or was it that you were part of a farming family?
It was much more the latter. It was, it's just been a stripe through everything I've done. I can't really point to a particular revelation or a definite thing other than perhaps my grandfather, who my maternal grandfather has always really been, was a galvanizing force in my life and my reverence for the earth, as was my grandmother, all my grandmothers and grandfathers. And it was out of that deep appreciation that's how I was drawn to focus my studies, to do my most interesting work, and that became my field of endeavor.
Hmm. What happened in that relationship between you and your grandfather that really sparked your interest in, as you used the word, reverence for the earth?
Well, in every way, from taking me and my younger sister hunting early on, which was not something girls often got to do. Mm-hmm. So we felt it was immensely privileged to go out with my father, my grandfather and uncles, whether it was gigging for frogs late at night or following him and a pair of beagles who were great rabbit hounds for small game. The reverence also began in the fields, following behind the horse and plow as it turned up the potatoes in late summer and autumn, from the butchering of hogs and goats and cattle. In the lower middle Tennessee, where I came from, goats were a delicacy. And as we moved around as a family, it was astonishing to me that they were eaten nowhere else, it seemed, in my young life. When we moved to New York and Connecticut, no one could even imagine ever having to eat a goat. So my interest in food is largely centered on vegetables, and for many years I have been a vegetarian. I'm not currently, but I will be again. As a child, I grew up eating all sorts of things and the strangest things in the world. I think my first punishment was from incurred because I ate something right out of the garden. Mm-hmm. And for that, I was spanked. I was very tiny, and I remember it was carrots, and I remember thinking that my parents had obviously made a mistake in punishing me, because there couldn't possibly be anything wrong in doing what I'd just done, and I've done it ever since.
So what does goat taste like?
Well, it's definitely its own flavor. As I've matured and become a little more worldly, I see that Mediterranean people, and certainly in the Southwest, there's an interest in goat, where it is a very almost sacramental meal at certain times and at certain holidays. Goat tastes like an interesting cross between mallard duck and mutton. And where I come from, goat's brains was the delicacy and was usually had at breakfast time. It was a rich energy food that was prepared with eggs in a very beautiful way. It's not something you'll find on many menus outside of Bean Station, Tennessee, but it was a very early soul food. My great-great-grandfather's favorite food in the entire world was roast possum, but outside of our little area in Tennessee, that was not anybody else's favorite. And as I've gone back to do my family genealogy and looking back at family history and folklore, it has been, again, that reverence for the foods from the earth and from the wilds, which is where my beginnings really are. My first book, Native Harvest, was really a study of wild edible foods and survival and the richness of backgrounds that come to us through many native cultures, which give us not just one cuisine, but many cuisines that we would call Native Americans. So Enduring Harvests has been a chance for me to really shout and stamp and celebrate the largesse that we think of as Native America. And what better way to look at it than through the lens of celebration?
Yeah. It seems to me that Native Harvests, which I got from the library last night, and Enduring Harvests, which I have from Globe Pequot, are companion pieces.
Yes.
And I was wondering, is Native Harvests, is it still in print?
Oh, my gosh, yes.
It's, oh, great.
It's an elderly book at this point.
It goes back into the 70s, yeah.
Yes. It was first published in 77. And then enlarged in 79 by Random House. And at the time, Random House saw it as a backlist item. And I didn't know at the time what a compliment that was. And it probably sells better now than it did when it first came out. It's selling strong. It has consistently. It's never been out of print, though sometimes it's hard to get. They've reprinted it so many times. And it has become a classic. I'm awfully grateful. It's sort of an old but wonderful book, and yet it has proved to be quite classic.
Hmm. High praise for it from Craig Claiborne, too, which is really nice. The most intelligent and brilliantly researched book on the food of the American Indian.
Yes, I was so grateful for that. I never met him and didn't know him, so those words were serendipitous to my work, to my young book, and to my ongoing work in the field. I've been most fortunate. It's been a lot of hard work. Now at the tender age of 53, I'm a grandmother with four grandchildren and still going strong and working hard to keep up with all the things I want to do each day.
Mm.
But my enthusiasm for the native foods and ethnobotany is itself so enduring and such a driving force in my life that it's my difficulty is having to sleep nights. I hate to waste any time. But then in the fruitfulness of it all, I've learned how to use my dreams to greater extent. So I'm never wasting and have no downtime.
Yeah. We're talking this afternoon with Barry Kavash, author of Enduring Harvests. That's her latest book. Her first book was Native Harvests. And we have a caller waiting to talk with us, and I want to get to that caller in just a moment here. I also want to invite others to give us a call and join our conversation this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. The number's toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And in Champaign-Urbana, in the local dialing area, our number is 333-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Well, let's go to the caller who is waiting for us on line 4 in Danville. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Real good. I was interested when they announced this morning because I picked up a book, oh golly, how many years ago? Back in the early 70s. And I tried to find the book a while ago and it's probably buried again. It's Native American Cooking by a lady called Yeffie something.
Oh, Yeffie Kimball, yes.
Yes, Yeffie Kimball, that's it.
Oh, yes.
And I found out the hard way that she uses way, way too much salt.
Oh, well, yes, my dear, but that, we can't Blame that on her. She has since passed away herself.
Oh, she has. Oh, that's a terrible shame.
It is. Her book is quite a classic, however.
Oh, her Light to Mine.
I believe she did it with Jean Anderson, and for many years it led the field, and I believe it has been reprinted. It was nonetheless a book of an era, which we have outdistanced and outgrown, thankfully, for the benefit of our very health. And when I began work on Native Harvest back in the 70s, many of my Native American friends approached me and said, please don't do to us what happened in that book. We are not so many cans of creamed corn or so many packages of frozen peas. Our food is so much more than that. And that's not a judgment call on that book. The book was written for an audience who ate, thought, and philosophized about food that way at that time. The book really is a period piece. But you need to look beyond that and read Yeffie Kimball's introductions and prefaces to the sections and the loveliness with which she loaned her talents in the drawings as well as in the intuition.
Well, the thing that struck me was going through her book, except for the excessive salt, which I have weeded out.
The sodium is quite detrimental, but so is the butter, the cream sauce, and as many Native people will say today, the real detriment is the tin can diet.
I will. I weeded out the tin cans, and I use fresh where I can.
Good.
I do use butter. I use real butter because I've got two people here with blood sugar problems.
Uh-huh.
And you do not use oil for blood sugar.
Oh, no, no, no. No, no.
But I have, instead of, and I think the baked carrots call for a whole stick of butter, I use half a stick for eight large carrots. And like I said, I took out that tablespoon of salt, and I put just a sprinkling of salt now with the herbs.
Yes, but you see, if you use a tiny bit of sunflower seed oil in place of any of the butter, and then a little bit of cider vinegar and or lime juice and lemon juice, you'll get even more taste out of carrots or anything else that you're cooking.
I agree with everything except the sesame, the sunflower seed oil. We love the sunflower seeds themselves we love. I grind it up and I put it in bread and biscuits and all kinds of stuff. But my family just will not take the oil. They'll spit it out.
Olive oil or safflower?
Olive oil, yes. Safflower, no. Canola, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, then canola.
Cold-pressed corn oil. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that struck me so clearly when I went through that book, she had a recipe for buckskin bread.
Yes.
That is identical to our trail bread.
Yes.
And I have found other things that are totally identical to the way my family cooks. Now, we are considered to be Scots.
Sure.
I know that my family, one of my family, my dad's family members, I should say, back in 1488, touched these shores. They had lost a mast. Here was this wonderful shore and all these masts, and they came ashore to get water and fresh food, and they cut the mast for the ship to return. But some of them wandered off for a few days, and I don't know whether they had contact with the people living there or not. Some of the family chronicles are missing, and they're having a terrible time searching attics and putting things together.
Sure.
But he stated in one diary he left behind that he was coming back, and we know he did come back. Mm-hmm. And we know he brought, even though it was not recommended, he sold his commission in the Army to become a civilian. He picked up his family, which her family, I think, really had a conniption fit. You're not going to take our daughter and our grandchildren. Well, he was the husband, he was the father. In those days, he had that right. Backed by his own family, he picked up his family, and he came back. He settled, and so far as we know, he had no trouble with the people living here. And I have no idea now what tribe it was, because things have shifted so much through the country, and tribes have shifted and intermarried and all the other stuff. But we know he came, and we know he settled, and we also know some of the other family members came and settled.
Well, certainly, and you see there's a tremendous Scottish as well as Irish influence throughout American Indian foods, and certainly through a lot of beautiful bloodlines. I know I have it myself. Bannock, buckskin bread, and many, many other things that are prepared in, so to speak, a Native American campfire or food endeavor will reflect food origins from many other places in the world. And you're very wonderful and perceptive to see this and to feel it. You see, living here on the threshold of the 21st century, our foods are truly international. And while we may look at a particular ethnic cuisine, we see many other ethnicities in it.
Mm-hmm. And in enduring harvests, one of the things that you point out, which is really a lot of food for thought, is that we might think of something like a clam bake as something being very New England-like, but really it is a Native American kind of way of cooking.
Oh, yes, and it's as a Northwest Coast as it could be along the shores of the Great Lakes, any of the river systems inland, freshwater as well as saltwater, and on the high plateau and prairies, earth-fired, steamed roots and tubers, and the catch from the land, as well as dried legumes and grains, can be roasted and baked in the earth, much as a New England clam bake might serve.
We've got another caller waiting to talk with us. Someone on line one in Naperville. Hi.
My boy spent 6 months on an Indian reservation in New Mexico student teaching.
Uh-huh.
He fell in love with your Navajo fry bread.
Oh, yes.
He brought home the recipe, and then he went back 6 months later to see how his kids were doing. And he said the flour for Navajo fry bread is different over there than it is over here.
Yes, flour, whether it's whole wheat or refined wheat, or depending on what type of flour is used, it can have regional differences. And it would be interesting to find out exactly what kind of flour he is used to they're using there. And a lot of the Navajo fry breads, along with a refined white wheat flour, they will also use dry powdered milk.
Oh.
And that gives an additional lightness and nutritional element, as well as trace extra vitamins and minerals, too. Because many people have a lactose intolerance, they have to be careful about the milk and the way in which they use it. But it boosts protein to put a little bit of dry powdered milk into the flour.
Oh, because he brought home the recipe, and I haven't tried it because he says you need another flour.
Oh.
But the cook that he from the dorm said, "Oh, I'll give you the recipe. I don't know if it's a customer ceremony. You have to stand by me first and watch me make it."
Well, isn't that wonderful? What a great invitation. You see, that's a very beautiful sharing and a personal statement in and of itself, because fry bread, as we know it, is universal. You'll find it on the Tibetan plateaus. You'll find people in Mongolia and in Patagonia fixing fry bread very much the same way that you will fix it with this recipe in your kitchen, or that I might here in my kitchen in Connecticut.
Well, when he went back the second time, he looked for the flour,
uh-huh.
And he said they only come in 25-pound sacks.
Uh-huh. Well, that's...
it would get wormy before I used all that.
Well, it depends. Chances are they are using a white whole wheat flour. You could probably use King Arthur or any of your favorite flours. Maybe you want to double sift it, and you might want to boost it with a more whole grain flour, but you'll have a finer, lighter bread, fry bread.
So what did you call it, a white
What? A fine white whole wheat flour.
Fine white
whole wheat flour.
Whole wheat flour.
Yeah, it wouldn't, though you could use rye or potato flour or any other type of flour, you wouldn't get exactly the same result.
Right.
You'd still get a delicious fry bread, but you wouldn't get the same results. And the Navajo are very particular and gracious about their fry bread, and your son obviously has made this a wonderful experience and has been invited to partake of it in a very special way, and I'm glad he thinks so highly of it.
Oh, my. Some restaurants down there have it on their menu, but he said he got to the point where he knew if it was, quote, authentic or not. Certain restaurants, he said, did it right, and certain restaurants, it didn't taste right. So he knew enough about it to know that much.
That's so beautiful, because you see, wherever you go in Indian country, you're going to encounter fry bread. At most of the beautiful dance festivals, at most of the celebrations, there are little tiny stands that rim the circles of our powwows here in the Northeast, and a lot of the people serve Navajo tacos, Navajo fry bread, and a lot of Northeastern people make their own fry bread. All over Native America, people make fry bread. It is an introduced, it's only been the past 400 or 500 years, so that's not too recent, but an introduced, not an old Native food, but it certainly has become a very particular and stylistic Native American food.
Well, I'll see if I can find that flour and take his recipe and see what I could make of it. And you say sometimes they use dry powdered milk.
Yes, ask him about that. Most of the Navajo recipes I'm familiar with, some leave it out, but some add it as an enrichment, and it also makes the fry bread lighter and puffier. And the Navajo pride themselves on beautiful, light, puffy fry bread. Exactly as you said, your son was invited to stand beside the cook and see how it's made. There are a lot of secrets to making really fine bread, especially fry bread. The less you handle it, the lighter it will be. And the way in which you handle it is a point of reverence. It will make it lighter. I have had the pleasure to stand beside Navajo people, Pawnee and Ponca people, Mohawk cooks, as they have made each their own versions. And you must pay close attention to how they mix it, the energy they put in it. And many of my friends say it's also the songs and the prayers you put in it.
Well, this is what he was wondering, because he was invited twice to peyote meetings.
Oh, yes.
And the third time, they didn't want a non-Native American, and he understood that. So he left. He thanked them anyway and left. But twice he participated in peyote meetings, and he really enjoyed the Native Americans to the point where he went all the way back the second time to visit them. So
I'm glad
up a new world for him.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It sounds like he's an especially sensitive young man, certainly well respected to have been invited as extensively as you speak of. And in this respect also, scientific research is finding many, many more honored and acknowledged uses for peyote because of its importance in health, and it's very important that the Native American Church be honored with its freedom, and that this particular plant be honored as a gift, as many would say, as a gift from the Creator.
I want to thank our caller for calling in this afternoon and sharing her stories of her son, and I would think that the next time that the two of them get together, they should make fry bread together.
Absolutely.
We're talking this afternoon about communal feasting, foods, and festivals of Native Americans. Our guest is Barry Kavash. She's the author of Enduring Harvests, Native American Foods and Festivals for Every Season. That's her newest book. Her first book was Native Harvests, Recipes and Botanicals of the American Indian. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're inviting your calls this afternoon, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. We have another caller waiting to talk with us on line 4 in Elburn.
Good afternoon. I've got some help for that last caller. You had recommended King Arthur flour, and it's difficult to find in this area. There aren't that many stores that sell it.
Oh.
But luckily, there's one in the town that she lives in. If she goes to the fresh food store on Ogden, they carry a line of the King Arthur flours. I don't know how many, if you can get it in Champaign-Urbana, you probably can, because it's creeping in different areas, and it's well worth looking for, because you can't always find it in the area. But Fresh Foods on Ogden has it. So that's the only thing that I wanted to tell her. Otherwise, you know, she'll be looking for it in the local stores, and she won't be able to find it.
Well, that was really nice of you to call in with that help.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Barry, when you wrote in During Harvest, in the book you write that these are recipes that very often don't get written down.
Right.
And so you, like one of our callers, her son, stood with people and watched them cook. Then what was the process like for you getting into your kitchen and trying to replicate recipes and then collecting them in this book?
Well, it is an ongoing dance of experimentation. The pleasure for me is really invention and in trying to recreate, to intuit and develop the foods according to the way people talk to me about them, tell me they're to the way in which they're supposed to look, feel, and taste. In many instances, it's just a process of development, because many of the recipes are simply spoken to me or talked to me. And often at times when I don't have a notebook or a tape recorder in hand. So it is an interesting piece of work to flesh them out. And in some cases, I've spent years trying to go back and develop the recipe exactly as an elder recalled it. And because that person isn't always there to taste it or try the recipe, I have to wait on the next time they come to visit to try it again. So I keep working with things until I develop them.
As a food historian and ethnobotanist, maybe you can talk with us about how it is that certain foods become so important, and there is a spiritual element, if you will, to a dish or a particular food. Corn comes immediately to mind, and you mentioned that there might even be a prayer when one is making fry bread. How is it that develops? Would you talk with us about that? What can you tell us about it?
Oh, a great deal, Celeste. Because food is our sustainer and our life sustainer, to many of the Mayan, Aztec, and Southwestern people, corn is the life giver or life sustainer. And in many cultures, they believe they come from the earth. They come from corn. And it is to corn and to the earth they will return. So there is already a great deal of reverence for many of the foods, and it's many of the earthier foods that possess the greater reverence. Much of the Native American approach to the food quest, however you acquire your food, whether you pick it or stalk it or hunt it or peel it, is a process of intuiting our needs and the needs of the substances we go to acquire. In the case of corn, the more, and this also would relate to anything, the more reverence and respect that you put in to the process of going to get that food, bringing it and refining it, measuring it, developing it, the more
love and prayers and good feelings you put into it, the more phenomenal it's going to taste. And then just imagine how much more nurturing it's going to be to anyone who eats it. And if we do that with everything, from a simple glass of water to the next hush puppies that we make or the next corn muffins that we bake, imagine. It's not just the simplicity of food, which is also very important, but it's the simplicity of the gifts that we bring to that food, what we weave into it, the way in which we make it, that enhances it and makes it unforgettable. And in this case, you don't need a complicated formula or recipe because it's got to come from you. And even if you're not a great cook, and even if you don't know what this is all about, you don't have to contrive or pretend to whip into a batter the love and the harmony you want your family to have.
Hmm. I don't know who said this, but it goes something like this. You can't be a good cook and a mean-spirited person at the same time.
Definitely not.
Yeah, so I suppose it goes to the same thing. Also, you know, many people say a prayer before breaking bread at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also a common occurrence in Native cultures?
Oh, yes, very definitely. But one must never wait until you get to the table to say that prayer. In this respect, the whole dance of preparation is a prayer, just as in Native American festivals, an entire dance will be a prayer. I maintain that the preparation of a whole dish is a prayer. And in many respects, that doesn't have to be trumped up or convoluted. It doesn't have to be outspoken or even audible. It can be silent and intuitive. One point, I do have several prayers in the book,
mm-hmm.
and this isn't a prayerful book. It's not coming from a particular religious standpoint or anything like that. But if you look at page 122, the Ghost Dance Religion, which concludes December and the end of the year, I point to a particular prayer and an offering in the spirit plate, which can be any small plate that's selected to hold a tiny bit of each of the foods that will be offered at that gathering or at that table. This can be at anybody's table at any time. It is a way of offering the best you have with your heart to give to the universe. It's actually a gift to the Creator, and or however you intend it. And in this respect, it's one of the more beautiful Native American ways of, as you say, breaking bread, or before bread is broken, the prayers are given. In much of Native America, the way in which the table is set is itself an altar to the food. And in many Native communities, an altar is created, and prayers are laid down with sacred foods before the food is brought out of the kitchen and served to the gathering that's there.
Hmm. We have another caller waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Let's go and talk with this caller. Hi.
Good afternoon. Would you please have your guest spell her name, first and surname?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Barry is B-A-R-R-I-E. And Kavash is K-A-V as in Victor, A-S-C-H.
Now, do the surname again. K-A...
V as in Victor, A-S-C-H.
C-H, Kavash. I thank you very much. Elegant program. Goodbye.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, thanks for your call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We don't have a lot of time left in the program. I'm thinking that maybe we should talk with you again sometime down the line when we can really get into maybe some more of the recipes and cooking techniques, and also maybe we could revisit Native Harvests, your first book. But maybe before we go, Before we get too close to our time here, we could share a short recipe. I don't know which one we mentioned, a couple, when we talked on the phone when we made our connection this afternoon.
Oh, yes.
Is there one that you, that wouldn't take a long time that we could pass on to the audience here?
I would love it. I, not only do I think of many, but Celeste, you did say there's snow there right now.
Yes.
Is it fairly fresh?
Yes.
Well, then the most instant audible recipe I can think of is the raspberry snow cream on 170.
Okay.
This is a childhood favorite. There are all sorts of complex and complicated recipes, and they're wonderful ones. And one I would direct you your attention to after, and I would love to visit with you again about this, is the Buzzard's Breath, Four Alarm Revenge Chili, which I do adore, and this is a vegetarian version. But I think the raspberry snow cream would be something instant and, spontaneous and serendipitous that anyone could do if they would like. And maybe many people will recall it from their childhood. I certainly do in Ohio. And what we would do is first gather a bowl full of fresh snow, fresh clean snow, and the drier the better, and working fast, because this is an instant treat, you dust a quarter of a cup to a half a cup of granulated sugar over it, and I usually make that a lot less because I don't have a sweet tooth. Sprinkle that with 1 teaspoon, more or less, of vanilla extract. Also, you could use almond or lemon or any of your favorites, but try vanilla first. Then whip this all together very quickly and lightly with a whip, and put it into little individual bowls, and then top it with frozen raspberries if you have it, or raspberry jam, or nothing at all. Just experience how absolutely ephemeral and beautiful this can be. And by its very nature, it should disappear quickly. If you don't eat it right up, it's gone anyway.
Yeah. Well, if people put a bowl out right now, they could probably have a snow cream later this afternoon, because it's snowing here pretty good.
Wonderful. Well, then do keep this this recipe in your memory, because it's a delicious treat and a tribute to each fresh snowfall.
Let's see if we can get another caller in here this afternoon before we go. Line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I was calling to ask a question about maple sugar from the Great Lakes.
Oh, yes.
And I helped set up a sugar camp early in the spring. And the syrup they gave me was very smoky tasting. And I was wondering if that's why they always made it into sugar cones instead of leaving it syrup.
There are a number of variations. It depends upon where and how the refining process takes place, and also how late in the season. The cones that you speak of are so important, and those were usually childhood treats for little people, but also big people love them. The smoky essence is quite delectable to some people, but possibly not for everyone's palate. And the smokier product is usually derived later in the season, whereas the fine AA or AAA syrup that's the palest amber is usually derived early on in the sugar process. There are so many grades and types of maple syrup. It depends upon not only the trees, but their sugar content, which can vary from tree to tree in a neighboring lot.
Interesting. Well, that's where we're going to have to end it for this particular conversation. I hope we get a chance to talk with you again.
Oh, I hope so, Celeste. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you this afternoon. Our guest has been Berry Kavash. She is the author of Enduring Harvests, Native American Foods for Festivals and Every Season. That book is published by the Globe Pequot Press. Her first book was Native Harvests, Recipes and Botanicals of the American Indian, and it is published by Random House. And Berry's last name is spelled K, A, V as in Victor, A, S as in Sam, C-H, Kavash. Barry, thank you very much.